Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Down Street in Queens, you know it? It was named for an icon of religious tolerance, John Bowne. If he could only see what it's like today. Now we continue our series, The New New York, Changes in the Way We Eat, Pray, and Listen to Music, which we're doing together with the Leonard Lopate Show, Soundcheck with John Schaefer, and the WNYC web team. We'll talk now about the rich history and current explosion of religious pluralism in Queens and the director of the borough's biggest mosque. My guests for this are Scott Hansen, history professor at Philadelphia University, who's also finishing a book called City of Gods, Religious Freedom, Immigration, and Pluralism in Flushing, Queens, 1945 to 2000, and M.T. Sherwani, director of the borough's biggest mosque, the Muslim Center of New York, on Geranium Avenue in Flushing. Scott Hansen, M.T. Sherwani, welcome to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks.
Thank
for having us.
Scott Hansen, Queens has a long history of religious tolerance going back to John Bowne in colonial times. Why don't we start there? Who was John Bowne?
Well, John Bowne was an important figure in the 17th century. Many locals in Flushing will tell you that it's the birthplace of religious freedom, which is a little misleading, but it did play a very important but often overlooked part in colonial history. Flushing's actually the anglicized form of the Dutch name Vlissingen. Its town charter of 1645 was one of the first in colonial America to grant religious freedom, or liberty of conscience as it was called then, which was important to the local Quakers or friends who settled there. When this right was jeopardized by Peter Stuyvesant, who was bent on persecuting anyone who was not a member of the Dutch Reformed Church, the people of Flushing came together to defend their town charter. In 1657, they drafted a document that has become known as the Flushing Remonstrance, which American religious historian Martin Marty has called a pioneering plea for religious freedom. Stuyvesant was not moved, though, and it wasn't until 1663 when John Bowne, who you mentioned, was banished from Flushing for holding Quaker meetings in his house, and then successfully appealed his case to the Dutch West India Company so that the town and the rest of the colony would more fully enjoy this liberty. Bowne House on Bowne Street in Flushing is the oldest house in Queens, and it's been operating as a historical society and museum since 1945, when Mayor LaGuardia actually came and did a radio broadcast for WNYC to mark the 300th anniversary of the founding of Flushing.
How about that? The Flushing Remonstrance, in which the Dutch were asked to allow religious pluralism, officially religious tolerance, in the colonies, or at least this colony, through Queens. So, Scott Hansen, what would John Bowne find if he visited Bowne Street today?
Well, Flushing today is perhaps the most religiously diverse area in the world. In a residential neighborhood and commercial district less than one square mile, there are half a dozen Hindu temples, two Sikh gurdwaras, several mosques or masajid, Japanese, Chinese, and Korean Buddhist temples, a Taoist temple, Falun Gong practitioners, over 100 Korean churches alone, Latin American evangelical churches, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, as well as some of the oldest churches and synagogues in the city.
Pretty amazing. And in your book you call this, or in a newspaper article you were quoted calling this, perhaps the most extreme case of religious plurality anywhere.
It's quite possible. I've been studying this for quite some time, and I think I can back that up.
So, M.T. Sherwani, you contribute to this pluralism in Flushing with the largest mosque in Queens. It's such a striking building, and we have some photographs of it that I'll walk people through on our website in a minute. So if you want to go to WNYC.org and click on the New New York, get ready for that. But I'm sure many non-Muslims also know it just from driving by it on Geranium Avenue, people from Queens. And you started very small, though, back in the 1970s, didn't you?
Exactly. It was June 1975 that we started renting an apartment on 41st Avenue. A few brothers who started it for Sunday school and for our weekly prayers, not daily prayers, Friday, because we were hardly a few hundred families throughout Flushing, but 10 or 12 of us were praying at different places every week. So we thought we should have our own place. And one room apartment we started, and today we have the biggest mosque, alhamdulillah.
And you have an incredible amount of diversity right within your own congregation, don't you?
Exactly. That is with Islam too. I mean, Islam doesn't belong to Arabs. It is not the property of Pakistanis. It is just like one God, one humanity, and one Islam peace. Same way, in our mosque, you'll find the people from Africa, America, Asia, Latin America, and even Australia and New Zealand.
Is that unusual? Because even within religion, certainly true in Christianity and Judaism, and I think primarily in Islam, people tend, you know, there are different branches of it, and people tend to worship with those from their own particular sect or those from their own part of the world who've come here.
It is true in one way only, but universally Muslims pray in a mosque wherever it is. Like if you go to Mecca, you will see the Muslims from all over the world. But if you go to Flushing, you will see mostly people from Flushing.
Yes.
However, those Muslims who are living in Flushing, as you just heard, they live from South Africa, from African continent, and from all over. They live in Flushing, and they come to our mosque.
And I was reading about the congregation having people from Syria and Bosnia and Pakistan and China.
Exactly.
And Somalia, so many countries from so many continents. And in the news in this country, we hear about all the different kinds of branches of Sunni Islam and Shiite Islam and the Saudi Wahhabi Islam and the Sufis. Is there a particular kind of Islam that you practice that can draw all these people together?
Okay, that's a good question. The fact is that, yes, in Islam there are sects. The most important are the Sunnis and Shias. In Pakistan alone, there are almost 82% Sunnis and almost 18% Shias. But our mosque is Sunni. As far as Wahhabism said, there's no such sect as Wahhabism. I tell you the truth. And I don't want to discuss Wahhabism on this time, but some other time maybe we'll discuss.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll talk about what the members of your congregation think about what Osama bin Laden probably would call Wahhabism when we return. This is WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with our contribution today to the new New York, changes in the way we eat, pray, and listen to music, our summer Thursday series in collaboration with Soundcheck, the Leonard Lopate Show, and the WNYC web team. We're talking about the rich history and current explosion of religious pluralism in Queens with historian Scott Hansen and M.T. Sherwani, director of Queens' biggest mosque, the Muslim Center of New York, on Geranium Avenue in Flushing. Our assistant producer, Ilya Meritz, and the folks who do our website have put together a great little slideshow tour of the Muslim Center of New York, including a photo of our guest, Mr. Sherwani. So you can go to the homepage at WNYC.org and click right through to the New New York section. And in a few minutes, we'll walk you through some of these slides together. So go to WNYC.org if you want to take part visually in that. And if you want to call in and speak on this segment, it's 212-267-WNYC, 267-9692. Scott Hansen, does your book about religious pluralism in Flushing have a thesis, or do you mostly just document the rise of this incredible tapestry of faiths?
Yes, there is a thesis, if I should go straight to the punchline, I suppose. Well, 40 years ago, Catholic theologian John Courtney Murray asked a question that seems particularly relevant for Flushing. He wondered how much pluralism, and what kinds of pluralism, that is, living with diversity, can a pluralist society stand? And I've found that the extreme case of Flushing suggests that there really is no limit. And the great importance of this community may be its example and lessons to the rest of the country. As Flushing's history really mirrors the national story in microcosm, you can really see the future of religion in America in Flushing.
But what is the attitude of the people of so many faiths toward each other? Is it, you know, are people even aware that there are all these other faiths in their midst in Flushing? Is there a kind of competition or hostility, as can take hold in some communities at some times? Is there just a casual indifference? What would you say?
Well, in Flushing and elsewhere, there really is a whole range of different responses to religious pluralism, of living with religious diversity, depending on who you talk to. Everything from cooperation to conflict, which can include various levels and forms of tolerance, and various levels and forms of intolerance, as well as those who just don't interact with anyone. As you said, you tend to see religious intolerance and hostility whenever a very different group of newcomers moves into an area that has been fairly homogenous for a long time.
Now, your book ends in 2000, but have you been there documenting how September 11th, 2001, and all the events that have flowed from it have affected Flushing and attitudes toward religious pluralism?
I have. I did. I went back. I was living in Providence, Rhode Island at the time, but I came back that weekend and every weekend thereafter, because Flushing actually has the largest Afghani population in the city, and there are some important Afghani mosques there as well. And, you know, there was some vandalism, some hostilities, but you saw the Afghani community actually coming out and marching to demonstrate their patriotism. 10 days after 9/11, Afghanis from one of the mosques marched to protest and chanting things like, you know, "We are not terrorists. You know, Islam is a religion of peace."
And M.T. Sherwani, this must have been a big thing in your center and probably to this day.
Of course, it was horrible, the attack itself, but it was double jeopardy for Muslims. On one side, we were hurt, our heart bleeds for the innocent lives lost. And I went to a few places and tried my best to console the people. And on the other side, we were looked as if we suspected, as if we were part of it. And we tried to assure the people that it is not Islam, it is not the Muslims. There are 1.7 billion Muslims, and Muslims might have been used, or Muslims might have gone astray, or might have gone crazy. But Muslims and Islams, they don't do it things like that. If you remember, there were some people who were drinking all night, and they were in the plane. Islam does not allow any drinking whatsoever. And any kind of terrorism whatsoever is killing, is a murder. And Quran says very clearly one place that if you kill one person, you kill the whole humanity. If you save one person, you save the whole humanity. So far, we are trying our best to remove the misinformation and disinformation, but our media, I have a complaint, is not cooperating. It wants to divide the society. For what? I don't know.
Is it possible for you to say which is more predominant among the members of your congregation, which is the biggest mosque in Queens? Disappointment about how they, as law-abiding Muslims, are now viewed in America, or anger at bin Laden and his ilk for doing what they do in the name of your beloved religion?
To be honest, most of us, we think that Muslims are at fault. They do not have the character and education. Islam is the best, but we as Muslims have failed. If we become the need of America, if we become the need of our neighbor, if we really work hard and practice our Islam as it is, the people will realize that it is so noble, it's so benign, it is so much peace and security. But not a single country in the world practices Islam as it should be practiced, either this extreme or that extreme. And Islam, the Holy Prophet, who is a walking Quran, said the moderation in the middle, the path is in the middle, the Sirat-e Mustaqim. So we are disappointed on one side from the Muslims' perspective, and also on the other side from media. But we honestly believe American people are very good people, they are innocent. If they don't listen too much TV, they'll be better off.
That's always good advice. This is New York Public Radio, WNYC 93.9 and AM 820. Our contribution today to our Summer Thursday series, The New New York, Changes in the Way We Eat, Pray, and Listen to Music. My guests are historian Scott Hansen, who has written a book called City of Gods, Religious Freedom, Immigration, and Pluralism in Flushing, Queens, 1945 to 2000. It's not out yet, though. And M.T. Sherwani, director of the borough's biggest mosque, the Muslim Center of New York on Geranium Avenue in Flushing. And let's take a phone call. Judy in Chelsea, originally from Flushing, right?
Yes, indeed.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I want to say first that I'm thrilled that Flushing is no longer so white bread. It's wonderful that there are mosques and Buddhist temples, Hindu temples, etc. But I do want to raise one point of controversy, and perhaps the historian could comment on this in particular. It seems that an awful lot of old Victorian houses have in the last probably 20, 30 years around Bowne and other streets in that general area have been torn down. And I wondered if there was any kind of historic preservation movement, if there was any kind of advocacy to save some of those blocks.
Scott Hansen, you familiar with that issue?
Yes. It's Flushing used to be primarily, up until, say, the 1950s, early 1960s, primarily a residential area. And then after the Immigration Act of 1965, which really opened the door wide open to people from all over the world again, for the first time since before the 1920s, that really began to change things. There were also a couple of other factors involved. Flushing was very popular site, you know, the former site of two world's fairs, the UN General Assembly even for a few years. It actually is the largest intermodal transportation point in the city, as far as buses and subways and airports and various roads. But I think one of the things that you're hitting on, the caller, that in addition to quite a bit of white flight that happened in the late 60s and in the 1970s, there was also a very flexible zoning law that dated back to 1961 that allowed many different immigrant groups to build so-called community facilities, which includes religious institutions, in residential neighborhoods as long as they met building and fire department codes. And it is the unchecked proliferation of religious centers, which even many Asian American residents in Flushing now realize is out of control.
Do you have some numbers?
Numbers of?
Religious centers?
As far as actual figures?
Yeah.
It approaches around a ballpark of 200 or more within this 1 square mile.
Wow.
And John Liu, the new Taiwanese-American city councilman of Flushing, to his credit, has been very vocal about the need to focus on zoning and land use reform. He once said that, you know, the church is a good thing, but too much of a good thing makes it less desirable.
Okay. Judy, thank you for your call. Now, I said we'd give you a guided tour of the slides that producer Ilya Meritz took at the Muslim Center of New York. So for those of you who are there on the website, great. For anyone else, you can still go to WNYC.org. and click on the New York to get here. And slide number one, Mr. Sherwani, is a picture of the mihrab, which is the pulpit from which the imam or prayer leader leads Friday worship. Do you want to describe this just a little bit as to what takes place
yes.
there?
It's almost 3.5 feet wide and 2 feet deep and almost 8 feet tall. And the imam stays almost inside, but he cannot be completely inside. He has to stay some of his body outside.
And it's kind of so like a little room open yes. on the side that faces the congregation, and there's a sort of a carpeted chair.
Yeah,
there.
That carpeted, he stands up and prays with all the other people. On that member, you see that podium type thing, he sits there and delivers his khutbah, we call khutbah, it is address
okay.
on Friday.
Slide number two is a picture of you, so if people want to put a face with a voice, you can do that with M.T. Sherwani right there. Slide number three, we see a library which contains Qurans and literature on Islam in many languages, including English, Arabic, and Urdu, with your population from all over the world. You have the Quran?
Yes, we have Pashto, we have French, we have Spanish, we have German, and we also have Bangladeshi.
And here, slide number four, is the outside of the building, which again may be a very familiar building even to non-Muslims who live in Queens. It's a beautiful new, as of about 15 years ago, very
8 years old.
8 years ago, yeah. Forgive me, building on Geranium Avenue, 137-58 Geranium Avenue in Flushing, red and gray granite. And it's set, what do you call the ball
there's
on top of the
there's
roof?
There's a dome.
A dome.
And then there's a minaret.
Right, the minaret.
Minaret. The mosque does not have to be exactly this way, but traditionally this is Moorish style and it started from the building. That one simple minar or the tower, it recognizes oneness of God all the way goes up, highest, tallest of the mosque.
And it is printed in English on the dome. There is no deity except Allah.
That means God. Almighty God. Arabic word for God is Allah, and Muhammad is the messenger of God.
So let me take a phone call for you from a secular humanist on that point.
Okay.
Sarah in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Thank you so much for taking me. My question may sound rhetorical, but since there is absolutely no evidence of the efficacy of prayer in any sector, any religion, what difference does it make what groups you have? Because the efficacy of prayer has not been shown to exist.
Okay, so I don't think we need to address the debate over whether prayer has been shown to be effective. You can if you want, but
it is not prayer in Islam as you say prayer.
Yes.
It is not we are asking God something to give us. It is what we are going in the prayers, say, thank you, God, what you have given us. And we are commanded that 5 times we should pray on time. And when we pray on time, God says that if you thank me more, I'll give you more. So it is for this world as well hereafter. We are commanded, we are ordered to pray.
Is it seen as at all of an aggressive statement, you know, in a community with so much religious pluralism to print a statement, there is no deity except Allah? Sounds very exclusive, very...
That is the message of
one
Islam.
One true religion.
That is the message of Islam, and we don't hide it, and everybody in the world knows it. And that is what we believe, one humanity, one God.
Scott Hansen, you're nodding your head. Is this an issue in a very pluralistic neighborhood?
Well, every religion has, I think, an equally valid claim to truth, to absolute reality, and... what the philosopher of religion Rudolf Otto called the numinous. In some ways it could be seen that way, but Dr. Shirwani is absolutely right that it's a very well-known tenet, and in Christianity and other religions you can find equally strong claims.
And if you're on the website, you can click through the rest of those slides yourself and see what's there. They're self-explanatory. One other thing, Mr. Shirwani, as you know, a member of our staff visited you at the mosque recently, and while he was there, there was a kind of incident. You had put up a poster urging members to register in a census to increase their political representation, and two younger members of your congregation came and tore the poster down and accused you of being too interested in becoming acceptable to mainstream America and to the white man. Is that representative of a larger division politically within your mosque community?
No, not really. There are some young people who are a little bit too emotional and too sensitive. They don't expect, they don't want us to go to the mainstream. But most of us, 99%, we are the part of America, we are the part of mainstream, and we are just regular law-abiding Muslim citizens over here. That is, they don't want even to register as voters, they don't want any census, they don't want anything. They want to belong to the 7th century or 8th century. That's not Islam. We are told wherever we go, the earth belongs to God, and we should try to improve, leave it better for our next generation.
And Scott Hansen, in our last 30 seconds, if this is the most religiously diverse community, perhaps in the history of the world, is it a grand social experiment of some kind? Is it, where can it go, or can it become a kind of religious Tower of Babel?
It is a grand religious experiment. It's the lively experiment that Tocqueville talked about and that other religious historians have written about. The challenge of pluralism, of living in a diverse community, is really, in the end, to learn to get along, to talk and tolerate and maybe even respect one another. Local volunteer grassroots, interfaith, and multicultural coalitions may have the right idea there, as well as education.
And it is the American experiment. And it's really on display in Flushing, Queens. I want to thank Scott Hansen, history professor at Philadelphia University. Have a book coming out one of these days. When it does, we'll talk about it again. City of Gods, Religious Freedom, Immigration, and Pluralism in Flushing, Queens, 1945 to 2000. And M.T. Shirwani, director of the borough's biggest mosque, the Muslim Center of New York on Geranium Avenue in Flushing. Thank you both so very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Leonard Lopate joins me. We'll talk about his segment in the New York Today right after this.